As if God were not a big enough topic, we've now got the afterlife and Shoah theology.
Well, I don't think you can have God without those things.
My mum tells the story of when she was a Haida teacher and asked her kids to draw the Garden of Eden. And one kid drew a line across the corner of the page and put a figure in that side. And mum comes around and said, "Oh, who's that?" And the kid says, "That's God." And mum says, "But we don't know what God looks like." And the kid says, "You do now."
Hello, everybody. It is good to see you all. Rabbi Robin Ashwasdeen, Rabbi Debbie Young Summers. I'm Rabbi Miriam Berger. It's good to be together. Although, Robin, I feel like we've seen each other at the Salem AGM. It's not often that between our rabbiting ons, I get to actually see you in person. How are you both? Yes.
Good. Just had some time off post all the chagim, all the festivals, time off being, just doing all the house stuff that's been left for months. So feeling quite bad because I kind of imagine that people think I'll come back after feeling refreshed and ready to go and actually just feeling tired from my other jobs. But yes, no, it's been lovely. And it's very autumnal in Manchester at the moment. So it's really pretty.
Robin has summarised my week off really well, the week of half term marked by, trying to do things with the family because they've not had a lot of me time, trying to sort the house out, lots of reorganising and going to the dump. And I have noticed that I have some tomato plants growing in the garden that I didn't plant, which is slightly concerning considering it's now November and they're doing really well. So I'm kind of conscious of how our seasons are changing. But we managed to get the sucker away without anything getting totally soaked. So that feels like an achievement for the week as well.
I feel I need to do a shout out to the Dysons for helping us put our sucker away. And I feel that October half term just draws a line under the chapter that is High Holy Days and allows us this kind of, 7 week festival free. Let's actually create community life because it's so difficult when you're on that treadmill trying desperately to just deal with the day to day and aren't able to kind of look forward at any point. But I was excited. I got a WhatsApp message to say a ticket had been sold for the JW3 Live. I mean, it was my sister saying she'd bought one, but I'm assuming that her being a trendsetter means that plenty of other tickets have also been sold. And I'm excited to be going live with you both.
Can't wait.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's coming quick though, isn't it? We said, 1st of December, great. Loads of time. And now it's like, it's around the corner. I'm sure loads of people will buy tickets. We're going to be inundated.
Absolutely. It will be wonderful to have a live audience and for them to be part of the conversation. So I'm looking forward to it a lot. We've been told that this week's podcast, we need to deal with some big issues of the moment. And therefore, we've gone straight in with God, because I don't think you get a bigger issue for three rabbis to talk about. So I'm wondering if we just start with is there a God image, a definition, a word, or something that is your go-to?
So my go-to quote really is from, I think it's from the film A Few Good Men. "You can't handle the truth." is that A Few Good Men? It's one of these army films. It's the idea that none of us can handle the enormity, the truth, the big picture. We just can't get it and we don't know.
I love that. Not where I thought you'd go. So what came to mind for me was Gabriel was really young and he was having a tantrum like a good rabbi's child saying, "I want to see God." And I was like, "You can't see God. God isn't a thing." I tried to give a really theological explanation of why you can't see God, but I want to see God. And I was like, "You can't see God, Gabriel." And my friend Rabbi Daniel Lichtman was there, I think, at the time, and said, "Gabriel, look into my eyes. Can you see God?" And Gabriel went, "Yes." He said, "God is in every one of us." And I found that so powerful because Gabriel as a child got it. He looked into a friend's eyes and saw something divine. And I was like, my gosh, if we could actually do that in the world, that we look in each other's eyes and see God. And that captures something about my theology, I think, and something that feels very deep.
I love it. I love it. I think I always go to the word chayim, meaning life. And the fact that there's two yuds in the middle of that word, which is a way of writing God, the way of writing God's name, an abbreviation of what the name we don't really know. And for me, there's something about that understanding that God is at the heart of life, that it's an abbreviation. We don't understand what that is or what that means, but that actually what is at the heart of everything living out there, looking at amazing views and looking into the eyes of others, are the two yuds, the name of God at the heart of all life.
Mm-hmm. Gorgeous.
So I think there's that thing of I've stopped after the High Holy Days and I'm sort of feeling like I need to put down lots of the different conversations that started happening at that time. And I had this beautiful moment where the Kol Nidre service had just finished and a mum and her teenage daughter came over to me to say, you know, the daughter had something she wanted to talk about and that she'd really struggled with the service. And why had she struggled with the service? Because we'd gone from the draft machzor of that we use on Rosh Hashanah into what we now call the old machzor, or really, which is the current machzor, but where the language of God is back from the last iteration of our siddur before it became egalitarian, and so much of the High Holy Day kind of God liturgy is so difficult, and I think that added to the what now feels really dated archaic language around God is one of those big conversations that I feel if it's really even being picked up by our teenagers as a problem, how much more so kind of the rest of us. Was that?
I mean, it makes loads of sense to me that it would be our younger generations that really meet that challenge, because they've grown up with the language of our new, still new, even though it was 2008, our new Siddur, our new prayer book. And there is such a dissonance between what was published 35, 40 years ago and what we now assume would be normal. You know, our language around God and gender particularly, I think, is one of the real dissonances when we go to the older prayer books. And I love actually that the prayer books we have, you can see the journey that we've been on as a movement. So you've got the 1985 Machzor, which we're still just about using, where there are no mothers in the Amidah and God is King and Lord and He. And then in the pilgrim festivals, the Shalosh Regalim prayer book, you've got a choice in the Amidah. You can choose the non-egalitarian side or you can choose the side where we've added the mothers. And that's where we were in 1995, wanting to give people an option. And now in our Siddur, it's all inclusive and there is no male language about God, which is such a strength, I think. I find often I go to friends' churches and the language of Lord and King is still so present. I find it really jarring. And when my vicar friends come to synagogue, they're like, wow, that's really amazing. How did you do it? And it's actually an incredible step that we now take for granted and your teenagers are taking for granted, which is wonderful.
I'm interested, though, that we, as a very diverse panel of people that chat to each other on Rabbiting On, are within a few years of each other and grew up with the same God language. Did it change your relationship? Do you think it's influenced your sense of God, having grown up with King, Lord, He, Father, all of that stuff?
That's a fascinating question. I'm not sure I've ever thought about how it impacted me as a child. To be honest, I'm not even sure I noticed it. Like, I don't think that it's amazing that the person in your community, the young person, noticed it and was able to say, I'm struggling with this, because I completely struggled with it this Yom Kippur more than any, which is interesting. But as a child, I think that it just builds the landscape for you, doesn't it? Like, you just, that is the world and God is male. And you kind of, it fits with a childlike understanding of what God is anyway, that kind of God on cloud, big beard, that it fits with it. I think it's probably only much later that I started to realize that you can think differently. And also how awful the word God actually is in describing what we're trying to even talk about. It was much later on. And I think it probably did shape me in some ways. But I need to unpack that more, I think.
And I think what you've just said, Robin, is actually the entire point of it. When our God language is male, of course we're going to envisage a masculine God in some way. I think it was Mary Daly said, if we use male God language, we make a God of man. the limits of our language are the limits of our world, right? And the language that we have is so limited, we're bound to limit God in anything we try to say about God.
Yeah. And it was only really like when I got started finding the works of like Marge Piercy and the work of the Kehenet movement, the priestess movement, who talk about God in very feminine terms, which is new to me, hadn't really come across that, then my mind was kind of blown. And it makes me think of the quote from James, you know, the band, "If I hadn't seen such riches, I could live with being poor." It was very much like that for me, like, oh, hang on a minute, have I been excluded from like what it is to be in synagogue if I'm worshipping something that is one take of what it could be, of what, you know, this entity or this force could be. And it's really only the work of like liturgists who opened my mind to like the possibilities. And I was like quite angry about that actually when I, and really that was at Leo Beck College. I have to say it was like really late on for me about seeing how you could talk about God differently and the liberation of getting rid of the word God altogether. But maybe that's a bit radical for the beginning of the podcast.
It's also interesting because I find the word God liberating because it doesn't really mean anything, right? It's a place marker for a word that we don't have. For me, as soon as you use words like Adonai or Lord or eternal, it's trying to define something. Whereas God doesn't, for me, actually mean anything. And so I always struggle with that thing of like when people say they don't believe in God or do you, you know, asking that question of do you believe in God? It's such a really like impossible question because you're using a word that we don't know how to define in order to know whether I believe in something or not. And so for me, there's something about the vagueness of the word God that's so open to personal interpretation that means I can sit really kind of comfortably or uncomfortably with God, my God, without knowing if that's the same God that you sit comfortably or uncomfortably with. You know, and I sit comfortably and uncomfortably at different times. I can picture myself. When I was a kid, my dad was head of the movement, and High Holy Days, we used to spend each service at a different community, often communities we didn't really know at all. And I can picture myself as a kid at Middlesex New, one Col Nidre, sitting in the front row. And so I was really like entranced in this open arc. And I was terrified. I don't know why I was scared. I felt that kind of sense of judgment and fear. And I can feel that anxiety of that kid kind of experiencing God, even though I've kind of always grown up with a very comforting kind of accompanying relationship with God, not a scary God.
But I think that vagueness that you talk about, for me, is what I love about Judaism and our theology. And I think, you know, saying Judaism has a theology is in and of itself quite a controversial statement because that vagueness sits so much at the heart of everything. So on Yom Kippur morning, we read my favorite bit of Torah in Exodus 33, when God is on the top of Mount Sinai with Moses, and Moses asks to see all of God. And the answer, of course, is no. No one can see all of me and live. And actually, that for me is the core of this experience. In Torah itself, in Revelation itself, we are told you can't know it all. So don't ever assume that you do. And always know that you can learn more from others. And I love to marry that with a beautiful midrash that Rabbi Sheila Shulman taught us about the Israelites all standing around Mount Sinai at the foot of the mountain and each one of them experiencing God in their own way, as they were able to, as their minds were able to. And in other words, we don't really know what happened there unless we hear 600,000 different accounts of it. And I think that, for me, is what I go out into the world to try and do. I want to hear everyone's different experience to learn more. I can expand my own understanding of God by learning yours. And I'm rooted in a theology of, I know very little. I call it a theology of humility. I know so little, and I'm endlessly hoping to learn more from you.
I love that. And that you remind me of, Sheila said, so Rabbi Daniel Lichtman teaches in the name of Sheila, that she said Judaism is being in relationship with God. What relationship and what God means is up for grabs, which is like really pithily, you know, expresses what you've just said about the vagueness of it. But I'm excited because I think I'm having my first disagreement with Miriam, because I really don't like the word God. Like, I think that it actually is the opposite of vague. It's too much of a box, I think, the word God. So I always caveat when I say the word God in any situation, whatever you mean by God. Because for me, when I say the word God, it just automatically puts a personal male being in the frame, which is not how I understand divinity. So I often say divinity. I write God with either G exclamation mark D or with a question mark in the middle, not because of the tradition of not writing God's name in full, although it's a nod to that mystery, but because I don't like the word God because it feels very Christian to me. It feels very particular. And I like the radicalism of being able, exactly as Debbie said, of like being able to interpret and express it. And very similarly, when people say to me, do you believe in God? Usually from a point of challenge, you know, like, because I don't. And I always say, I'm sure we actually are talking to the same, you're talking about something different. I'm sure we actually believe, for want of a better word, in very similar things, like the sense of wonder and awe, the sense of being deeply connected, of finding a bit of heaven here on earth, using the words of Rabbi Lionel Blue. And God for me is a separator word, not a connector word. So there you go. That's our first argument.
I'm happy to take on the challenge and take on the argument, because I think actually there's something about enabling us to be able to hear within such a simple word the layers of struggle, of like, I don't have a one answer to this question. And actually, I need a different answer to that question at different moments in my life. This is the moment where I would love Cantor Zoe Jacobs to just be in one of these squares on my screen as well. Because there's a beautiful piece talking about a bit of Torah that Debbie was referring to in Exodus that we read on Yom Kippur morning. We use the quote of God's attributes lots during in liturgical ways as well. And Zoe enables the community to sing it with two very, very different tunes. And kind of, I grew up in a synagogue where those words were Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'chanun, you know, that very male, very majestic, kind of scary kind of God. And yet there's other times where we use Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'chanun, Adonai. At this point, Zoe is like sticking pins in our eyes going, no, this is not what I...
It's lovely.
But you get the general gist. And this like warmth of a God who is able to walk life's journey with me and accompany me. And, you know, I know we've all had similar struggles in life and kind of the times where we turn to God. You know, we've all been there with fertility issues. And for me, you know, Torah sends us at those times to the punishing Adonai, Adonai, you know, scary God who's like, what have I done wrong? Why, you know, why aren't I blessed with as many children as I want? And yet for me, there's a way of being able to find within God that arm around my shoulder that says, maybe you're being protected from something you didn't even know you were being protected from. Maybe actually this is the life that was intended for you. And it's hard not to say it with some kind of like, I don't believe in predeterminism. You know, I do believe that we have free will. I don't believe my whole life was mapped out. But still, yet there's something about a comforting, accompanying God that can say, you don't understand everything. And maybe even the things you want, you know, almost like a childish way, sometimes the things our children want are not the things that are best for them or best for the world. So they don't always get it. And maybe we need to see ourselves in that kind of childlike role sometimes too.
There's a real challenge in all that though. Like I find partly because of those struggles and, you know, losing parents young and those kind of things that we've shared, the idea of an interventionist God is very problematic. I know, Miriam, you wrote your rabbinic thesis on the healing prayer, and that was something I struggled with so much at rabbinical school. You know, I spent a year praying for healing that wasn't granted, and my dad still died. And again, we're back to that challenge of what the word God actually means, right? I don't have this sense of a person. It's not a person who's with me, or it's a force that I don't understand that's well beyond that. And actually, the prayer part of it is about changing ourselves. Yeah, I think that the God that people don't believe in is the interventionist God. And that for me is definitely truth. But the challenge comes when we marry that to our liturgy. And I was actually asked this a few months ago in a shiur, how is it that we continue to pray words, particularly from like the Psalms and but even more modern liturgy, that actually we can't believe or don't believe? And that I think there are multiple answers to that, part of it being the comfort of saying words that connect us to our history and to our ancestors, but maybe also ties in with that diversity of how different people experience God, right? I might be saying a prayer that's your experience of God, but not mine. And, you know, when we find those multiple expressions, and going back to what you were saying earlier, that's one of the reasons I quite often refer to God in the feminine, not because I think God is female, but because it jolts people out of the comfort of the language that we're used to say, oh, maybe God's not male. I don't think God's female, but maybe God's not male if I use female language. And just, we just need to be taken out of our comfort zone a bit sometimes.
Yeah. But I think like the beauty of, and the one of the reasons I am Jewish and a rabbi is because I love living in the paradox. I don't, let me say that again, I don't actually love living in the paradox. I find it really frustrating. I'd much rather have complete certainty. But I want to live in the paradox more. So Rabbi Lionel Blue, because he was great about talking about God, wasn't he? Fred. Like he very much talked about a personal God he called Fred, which I loved because it was so joyful and playful. But he would teach about Adon Olam, the prayer at the end of our service, that begins with kind of what we're talking to, of like, you know, if we were going to write what we actually believe would be some kind of force or something greater than ourselves that isn't personal, no interventionist God, all of that stuff, you know, you're greater than me, God we can't even name. But Adon Olam ends with, in your hand I lay my spirit. Very, very personal, very visceral, God having a hand. And Rabbi Lionel Blue was like, there's that dissonance, there's that paradox that we hold. So as much as I say, I don't believe in a personal God, and I really don't. I don't believe in fate. I don't believe that there is an entity out there that I'm praying to change things. I still end up there. Like, you know, however much I say it, when I was like coming out of surgery, I was singing that last, I literally was singing, very geekily Jewish, I know, singing that last line of Adon Olam, Biyado Af Gid Ruchi. That's where I end up. Like, and it's not about us. I think is exactly as you said, Miriam, it's about letting go of that thing about believing, but actually what do you experience? What's helpful to you in the world? And the same with prayer, because we also had a shiur at Yom Kippur about this as well, about how prayer doesn't reflect rationally what we believe. That's all, that's not its purpose probably. It's poetry. It's an enabler to let us step into something else. And Dr. Jeremy Schonfield, who teaches at Leah Beck College, always says, a scholar in liturgy, that it's all about understanding it as mantra and poetry. It's not meant to be rational. It's meant to be a gateway to something and hopefully a challenge as well, I think. It should be that we're challenged and we're comforted in measure. So I'm used to now living in the paradox of things that I believe in, things that I don't, things that I turn to that I thought I didn't believe in, but just finding what feels comfortable and helpful in the moment.
I think it also gives you like a whole armory, right? That actually, there are so many that, you know, for me, the reason that we have all of these different expressions and experiences of God to kind of delve into in our very different liturgies and our different biblical narratives and our different theologies is because you don't get one God for life. You know, you get those different attributes at different times. You like dip into them. You need them differently at different times. And so for me, there's that real sense of, you know, I would certainly not think of not looking when I cross the road because, well, you know, it's okay. God will pluck me out from in front of the wheels of the car because I wasn't intended to die at that moment. That's certainly not a God belief that will, that works for me. But that sense of, you know, if God forbid somebody I loved was run over, I think I'd turn to that Heschel moment of like, don't ask where was God, ask where was man. I think you can feel an accompanied a sense of being accompanied by God without needing an interventionist God who's going to not make terrible things happen. You know, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think there's a sense of kind of needing to be held by those different senses of God. I sat through rabbinic school for the first couple of years with my brother in synagogue next to me, where Aleph had just kind of introduced prayers for healing. And my brother would hiss in my ear next to me, "I can't believe you can join in. It doesn't work," right? And that was really the motivation for my thesis of like, what is this moment for? And there's something about the collective power of those prayers for healing. What does it mean to bring those people into the consciousness of the entire community? Is that about some higher being? I certainly don't believe in a God with a prescription pad in the sky, because, you know, that God has got the prescription allocations wrong many, many times. But what does it mean to be able to focus our thoughts, our energy, our communal anxiety together and hope for a better next step?
I'm loving this conversation. I've got so much to say. I love the idea of God with a prescription pad up there, like the negligent doctor. Really works. And it made me think of Gabriel did a video, my 10-year-old, of the days of creation for his Jewish studies homework, because he did Lego of all the different days in a little video. So he was like, day one, day and night. Day two, God separates the water, went through all at the end. And then we got to the seventh day and he's like, day seven, Hashem, because he goes to an Orthodox Jewish school. He's like, Hashem rests with his friend and they have Shabbat together. And he did two little people. I was like, oh, Hashem has a friend. And I was like, I love the imagination of kids that actually there was just so much like possibility there, but we like tend to hold on, and Rabbi Danny Newman talks about this, we hold on to our childlike understanding of God as adults and it becomes so much more fixed. But actually a childlike understanding of God that maybe is more kind of anthropomorphic and in, but has a lot more imagination. So Hashem sitting with his friend, and actually theologically we know that Gabriel's onto something, because in Genesis God says to his mates, the angels, I guess, is what we say they are, let us make God, man in our image. So there is a sense that Gabriel was ahead of his time, and actually he understands the theological implications.
He just read chapter God two already.
He's, yeah, really ahead. Yeah.
My mum tells the story of when she was a Haida teacher and asked her kids to draw the Garden of Eden. And one kid drew a line across the corner of the page and put a figure in that side. And mum comes around and said, oh, who's that? And the kid says, that's God. And mum says, but we don't know what God looks like. And the kid says, you do now.
That's brilliant.
If only we all had that sense of depth of faith.
Certainty. I love that.
But prayer, of course, I think prayer is, as we were saying, like this thing that we do to change ourselves, right? The Hebrew verb is reflexive. It's about not necessarily God changing things, but us acknowledging those who are healers in our community, those who support the sick, our desire to support one another as a community and to bring into action those things that we pray for. I think there's always that sort of, you know, does prayer change God or does prayer change us? And for me, I'm very much on the prayer changes us side. How could anything change God?
I think it's a bit of both for me, because I mean, as much as I'm saying I don't believe in a personal God, I definitely believe that there is something greater than myself I'm connected to, you know. So I think that prayer absolutely primarily is about me changing myself, but I really believe in the power of, I always think it's amazing, like on a Shabbat, the community coming together to be transformed, hopefully. No wow moments, Lionel Blue would say, you know, you can't expect God to turn up at 11 o'clock on a Shabbat morning and, you know, meet you. But the idea that, you know, over time we come back and back, we're being transformed, we're looking to be better people, to create a better world. Our liturgy is all spurring us onto that. We're reading stories that help us transform and have critical thinking. And we all do that as a collective, and we step out into the world. So we are like completely transforming it. And I do think that if there are more spaces, and I don't mean necessarily Jewish spaces, but spaces that enable all of that, the world and the cosmos divinity is shifted. It has to be a partnership. Like, I'm not sure I'd be up for something if I thought I couldn't have an effect. Like, I think a lot of prayer is challenged to the universal divinity. So I think, for me, I think it's a bit of both.
I love this, like, if we were building a roadmap of this conversation, I feel like there are so many different routes that you know, you can't really talk about God without, like, we've gone on to prayer, we've gone on to the kind of attributes of God, but we've gone on to prayer. There's always that thing of kind of free will. Then there's that sense of, for me, there's something about the afterlife, and that if this is just also a narrow snapshot of what it is that is kind of part of that which is out there, then actually for me it's much more kind of a comforting, you know, I like the image of this is just a sort of a waiting room, that there's doors ahead that lead us somewhere else. And I think, I wonder if we talked about, well, what do we believe comes next? Or do we believe anything comes next? Does that then affect, well, do you believe in God? Or what does your God image look like? And there's also that kind of that free will, that evil and suffering, all these major topics, you know, can't possibly kind of stay with, like, not affect this conversation around God. You know, I'm fascinated that the huge bulk of theology that really expresses God came post-Shoah, came after the Holocaust, but actually didn't come till like the 60s. That it was as if the Holocaust kind of remained in this box where everybody went, you know, in almost in shock. But now what? What does that, we're meant to be in a covenantal relationship with this God. And how could that have just happened to the chosen people? And then kind of 20 years on, people were able to start unpacking, has our relationship with God changed, or does our belief in God, is it affected by this kind of cataclysmic moment? You know, do the challenges of life affect your God image?
As if God were not a big enough topic, we've now got the afterlife and Shoah theology.
Well, I don't think you can have God without those things.
No, totally. And actually, I think there's something really fascinating in terms of post-Holocaust theology, that we are now a generation moving into a time where the testimony of survivors will be gone. And there was an amazing podcast about Daf Yomi, the study of Talmud every day, that I was listening to a few years ago, where she was arguing that the generation that were writing the Mishnah in 210 CE were basically responsible for deciding what would the destruction of the temple mean for the next generations. And we stand at the nexus of that theological point in terms of the Holocaust. You know, it's just one of the greatest challenges of our age, really. You know, you have Orthodox rabbis like Yitz Greenberg saying anyone who chooses to be part of a Jewish covenant now is a Jew by choice, because the covenant was broken at Auschwitz. And for an Orthodox rabbi to say that is quite astonishing. Yeah. But yeah, I think it is one of those great kind of trump cards in a way that people play.
We also know that there are like horrendous war crimes and genocides going on as well. I mean, you know, we can open our ears and still hear them now. And there is a challenge to us about what it is to lead meaningful Jewish lives. I also think that we're going to have to come back to this to have more conversation. I feel like we've opened up to the biggest of the God questions. I've got lots more to say. I know we all do. And I think that when we come back from our live together on the 1st, we're kind of talking a little bit, aren't we, about Jewish continuity and what it is to be Jewish, and kind of why be Jewish going forward. This is one of the things that we have to be able to talk about, isn't it? We have to be able to find space to be in our complicated, messy, violent world as people who are covenanted.
In covenant.
Yeah, that works. In covenant, there we go. Just please edit that down. In covenant with this. So maybe we'll return to it. But
there's something for me about leaving people with a kind of perhaps a gentler image. And for me, there's no difference for the horrors of the Holocaust to every individual that has faced their own moment of grief, tragedy, that sense that how can you live on after you've experienced or witnessed something? And that if one's belief can cope with, you know, a single child dying of cancer in an NHS hospital in Britain in 2022, it's actually no different to the mass horrific sense of how do we make sense of the loss of 6 million lives or other genocides around the world? And for me, there's something about God's, the Hestepanim, not just being that kind of withdrawn face, but actually God weeping with us. And that how can we feel a sense of being accompanied, being in relationship, being with God as the ultimate beings with free will? And therefore, you know, this sadly is what happens. This is the world we live in. And what can we do to ensure that we do our bit to make the world a safer, happier, friendlier, healthier place, rather than to think that that kind of that shifts a relationship or a problem onto God for having created this moment or being responsible for this moment. So yeah. I think this conversation got a lot heavier than our, you know, suggestion of us rabbiting on together should ever have got. I think we really should be having the conversation about what on earth are you wearing at JW3 on the 1st of December? You know, if you're going to be in some like slinky black dress or a ball gown, I don't want to turn up in my tracksuits or a onesie.
Do we want to choose a colour scheme?
Yeah, definitely. Zoe, Deborah and I often make sure that our kippot are matching when leading services.
Oh, wow.
I think there's that nod to like, you know, what does it mean to have three women on a stage or three women on a bimah? Maybe producer Dan will not only get the link out there to people so that they can buy tickets, but also make sure that we're accompanied on a journey of deciding what we're going to look like up on that stage as well. It is great to have had an opportunity to chat and be together and rabbiting on. I look forward to seeing you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Rabbit on.